Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline across the top of the page, Slashing Not at End, Wake Schools Face Cuts. And this article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. And the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. At the far left, there's a picture of a man in his office sitting at his desk wearing a tie, looking over some paperwork. The caption reads, David Cook oversees Wake's budget as county manager. If anticipated state budget cuts come to pass, Wake County could face another workforce reduction, perhaps as high as 5%, as it struggles to balance its next budget in 2011. With early discussions just beginning for the new budget season, all numbers are preliminary, and the county really doesn't know how deep a revenue hole it will be looking at. And a lot will depend on what the state does, says Wake County Manager David Cook. But 5% would be possible if we have to take cuts from the state. Over the past two budget seasons, in the face of a double-digit decline in sales tax collections and other revenue negatives, the county has eliminated 200 positions from its employee roster. In 50 cases, workers occupied slots that were eliminated. They were placed in other jobs, allowing the county so far to avoid large-scale layoffs. With good planning, you can handle these things, Cook says. The county's employee roster now stands at about 3,690. That's down from 3,845 in July 2008. The county's budget process begins December 8, with formal adoption of a 2011 to 2012 spending plan coming in June. But speculation already abounds that the size of revenue gaps to be faced as one-time federal recovery money dries up and the state struggles to compensate for a projected revenue gap of $3.6 billion. It's going to be brutal, says Wake County Commissioner Stan Norwalk, who says all budget numbers are highly preliminary at this point. But I will say that next year is shaping up to be as hard a year as we have faced. Wake County's biggest expenditure is for the public school system. Norwalk says Wake schools could take a hit of $100 million to $130 million, depending on what transpires with state and federal funding. And I don't mind you saying that, he adds. In 2010, the county paid $313 million, or 26%, of the total Wake schools budget of $1.2 billion. The state paid 56% of the school budget. The federal government accounted for 12%. Not only are state and federal allocations in question, the county's regular sources of revenue remain depressed or flat, with potential repercussions for the remainder of Wake County services. There is just no indication that we'll be looking at a sales tax recovery anytime soon, says Wake County Commissioner's Chairman Tony Gurley. And that's one-third of the budget. The other two-thirds are property taxes, which have been level. Wake property tax revenue rose by 1.4% to $626 million between fiscal 2009 and fiscal 2010. Sales tax collections, meanwhile, fell by 19% to $127 million between fiscal 2008 and 2009. Gurley says he has not seen detailed budget information at this point. Back in July 2008, before the financial downturn hit, Wake's total expenditures were $984 million. A year later, with sales taxes falling, that total budget expenditure number had been trimmed by 3% to $953 million. The budget document recommended by Cook and approved by the county commissioners for the current fiscal year, which began July 30, cut $2 million more out of county spending to $951. In addition to cutting mostly vacant positions, Wake County leaders so far have been able to make ends meet over the past 3 years by scrimping and cutting around the edges, including delaying library and school construction and renovations, among other tactics. Other Triangle counties are in similar straits. In Durham County, during fiscal 2009 to 2010, hiring, travel, and wages were frozen. Projects delayed, and 34 positions in the sheriff's office and general government were slashed. Orange County didn't cut positions but ordered a 10% reduction in expenditures, such as overtime, spending on temps, and general operations. In Durham County, officials already are holding preliminary discussions about their 2011 budget process, but have not alerted department heads to prepare for any across-the-board cuts, says County Manager Mike Ruffin. He says he needs to see more complete property tax data, due out in November, and post-holiday sales tax figures, due out in March, before he draws any firm conclusions about 2011. He does say, however, that whatever those numbers show, Durham County officials will have to take a hard look at three areas: schools, debt serve, and county employee raises. Durham County employs 1,937 workers. Our employees have not had a raise in 2 years, and that fact is beginning to show up in our turnover rates, Ruffin says. Attempts to reach Orange County budget officials were not successful. And now we move down the page from that article to the center of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article has a black border around it, and within that border, first at the top, there's the top half is a large picture, outdoors, a wide shot of a crane next to a building under construction with just the bare bones in it, and there are some other buildings around and trees in the background, and in the upper left-hand corner of that picture, there's another picture of a man in coat and tie sitting at a table, some papers in front of him. The caption on the small picture says, "Chancellor Randy Woodson tasks two vice chancellors with heading up research panel." And starting in the larger picture and beneath it, there's the headline, "Centennial's Little Village, Woodson orders study of town center for campus." And then underneath that is the article written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a dateline of Raleigh. Already home to an Arnold Palmer-designed golf course and condos, NC State University's Centennial Campus next could feature a town center of boutique shops and restaurants. Newly installed Chancellor Randy Woodson has tasked two associate vice chancellors with heading up a committee that will look into adding a new element to the campus, which is a mix of academics and corporations engaged in research. Heading up the exploratory panel are Tim Luckadoo, who oversees student services, and Michael Harwood from the Centennial Campus Development Office. The town center could include a mix of restaurants, shops, and commercial development on a 12 to 15 acre site along Main Campus Drive that overlooks Lake Raleigh. It would most likely be funded and built by a private development group, but Luckadoo says it could still be a year or two before requests for proposals will be sent out seeking a private partner for the project. The committee's report to the chancellor is due February 1. "We're examining all possibilities now," Luckadoo says. "The idea is how to build a project so people on Centennial Campus and people not on Centennial Campus will want to come there. It can become a destination." Centennial Campus is already a destination for thousands of students attending classes and conducting research in university buildings. More than 2,000 corporate workers and executives also have office and research facilities on Centennial Campus that are leased by companies including Red Hat, ABB, McKim & Creed, and WebAssign. Centennial also has a full plate of projects on the cusp of construction, including a conference center, a Class A office building, two apartment projects, and the restart of the Shores residential development. Harwood says each project is making progress toward finalizing agreements with the university and securing its financing. To be unveiled in the summer of 2012 is the James B. Hunt Jr. Library, which is designed to be a landmark architectural statement for NCSU. "The momentum is in place that didn't exist even a couple of years ago," Hardwood says, adding that a retail and commercial town center has been an element in the campus's master plan since the first spade of dirt was turned 25 years ago. The report from the committee to the chancellor is expected to set parameters for private developers that may be interested in becoming involved. As with all other privately developed buildings on campus, the university would negotiate a long-term ground lease with a development company. The university would also have final say on which tenants could occupy the space. Luckadoo says the committee will take field trips to mixed-use development communities and meet with private developers around the region to gain an understanding of what type of development would be appropriate for Centennial. There's not many examples of this on college campuses, though, he says. The College of Charleston, in 2007, completed construction of its campus center, which is a three-building project developed by McAllister Development Company of Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. The 500,000-square-foot project covers a city block on the edge of campus in downtown Charleston. It includes ground-level retail with a CVS drugstore, a specialty food store, a clothing store, and a deli restaurant, as well as a 500-space parking deck, apartments for upperclassmen, and a freshman dormitory with a cafeteria. The Centennial Campus Town Center could potentially be four or five times larger than Campus Center in Charleston, Harwood says. Timing is of the essence, says Reed Tyler, executive vice president of Raleigh's Keystone Corporation, the developer of Centennial Campus's newest office building, which opened earlier this year. They're trying to get the campus to be more of a 24/7 environment, and if you talk to anyone who is trying to lease office space, a lot of corporate tenants are looking for space where they can walk to amenities, Tyler says. And moving just to the right of that article, the next article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal runs vertically along the right side of the page. First, at the top, there's a picture of a construction site with no buildings, but showing a sign in front of it that has a drawing of what is planned to be there. The caption reads, "Kane Realty is reworking plans for the Cardinal." And then under that, there's the headline, "Hospital keeps Cardinal plan." And this article is written by James Gallagher with the Dateline of Realty. And also within the article, there's a face shot only of John Kane, the chairman and CEO of Kane Realty Corporation. For now, Duke Raleigh Hospital remains committed to relocating its wellness center from its main campus to the Cardinal at North Hills, despite the Cardinal's continued delays. Kane Realty has long had on the drawing board plans for the Cardinal, a continual care retirement community at North Hills, but the Raleigh company recently withdrew its application to the State Department of Insurance to construct the facility and said it would redevelop the project in a different format. John Kane, chairman and CEO of Kane Realty Corporation, has said the turnaround on the new plan will be quick, with details to be released within a few months. Should the Cardinal experience continued delays or its development become uncertain, and Duke Raleigh believes that will not happen, Carla Hollis, Duke Raleigh's chief marketing and planning officer, says the hospital will begin looking for a new location, likely in the North Hills area. "Certainly we're anxious to see this move forward," she says. "If at some point in the not-too-distant future we believe that won't happen, we're going to move forward and look for another site." While the new plans remain undetermined, Duke Raleigh says it remains committed to its initial plan. "At this point, we anticipate going forward on the basis we discussed," says Duncan Yagi, Duke University Health Systems Director of Planning. "I've heard nothing from Kane or co-developer Dave Falk to lead us to believe we should not anticipate going forward." Representatives of Kane Realty declined requests for comment beyond a previously issued news release. The Cardinal, as originally envisioned, would be a $150 million retirement community in which residents are provided all levels of care as they age. Duke Raleigh agreed to move its wellness and rehabilitation center there to provide services to the Cardinal's residents as well as to its patients and to members of the community. The move would allow Duke Raleigh to expand from about 7,500 square feet on its current campus to about 20,000 square feet and give it access to a swimming pool. Hollis says the hospital needs the additional space to grow the center's membership. Currently, the center has about 200 members, and Duke Raleigh wants to grow that to about 1,000. Duke Raleigh lacks the space on its existing campus to grow the center. Already, the hospital is moving administrative offices out of the main building and into an office building at 1300 Navajo Drive as part of an effort to reduce congestion in the hospital and make room for clinical expansions. The hospital is expanding its oncology department and has filed for state approval to add two operating rooms and expand the surgical department. The Wellness Center is currently located in a small building on the southern end of the campus. Hospital President Doug Vincel has said that building likely would be demolished and replaced with a new structure. Hollis says that the hospital believes Kane will start construction of the newly designed Cardinal in early 2011. And our last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline, Medicaid patients to surge, cost state millions more. And then on the far right side of the article, there's a picture of a man standing at a podium, wearing coat and tie, speaking. The caption reads, DHHS Secretary Kanzler says roles will grow by 500,000 to 600,000. And this article is written by James Gallagher with the Dateline of Raleigh. The state's Medicaid rolls could grow by as many as 600,000 come 2014, potentially imposing hundreds of millions of dollars in new costs on the state. The Federal Affordable Care Act, or Health Care Reform Bill, expands the criteria for Medicaid eligibility, allowing anyone within 133% of the poverty line into the program. And the bill requires those currently eligible but not yet enrolled in Medicaid to be entered into the federal health care program. Medicaid provides health care to children, the poor, and some adults and elderly. North Carolina Department of Health and Human Resources Secretary Lanier Kanzler says he is expecting the Medicaid rolls to swell by 500,000 to 600,000 people once the reform is fully implemented in 2014. The state currently has more than 1.7 million people on Medicaid. About 200,000 to 250,000 of those new enrollees are currently eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled, while the remaining individuals will become eligible once the federal government expands the criteria, Kanzler estimates. The distinction between the two types of new entrants to the program is important. For those who become eligible because the federal government expands eligibility, their costs are largely borne by the federal government. The feds will pay the full cost of the first 3 years, after which part of the cost is slowly shifted to the states, which eventually will be responsible for 10% of the bill. For those who are currently eligible for Medicaid but for one reason or another are not enrolled, the state will pay a larger share, about 33%. As a result, the department is planning for the state's cost of providing Medicaid to jump by as much as $300 million annually. The state currently spends about $2.4 billion providing care, while the federal government provides about $9.5 billion. The state has had trouble meeting the demands of Medicaid. The state ran a $221 million deficit in the Medicaid budget during the 2010 fiscal year, which ended June 30th. As of now, the state is ahead $140 million for fiscal year 2011, says Kanzler. Still, Kanzler remains concerned about whether the state can continue to cover the costs of the entitlement program. I continue to have conversations about the long-term sustainability of Medicaid if we don't find a way to slow the growth of the program, he says. But others say the state may be taking a conservative approach to the situation. It remains unclear exactly how many and how quickly people will enroll in the program, and of the new enrollees, how many will consume health care services. A study by the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured estimates that between 2014 and 2019, North Carolina will spend about $217 million on those who are currently eligible, but about $811 million on the newly eligible. The federal government, by comparison, would spend $397 million during that time on the currently eligible versus $20.3 billion on the newly eligible. One reason the cost differences between the two groups are so large is that many of those who are currently eligible but not enrolled in Medicaid do not frequently use health care services. If they did, doctors and hospitals would enroll them in the program to ensure they get paid. It remains unclear whether those individuals, once forced by the federal government to enroll, will begin to or will need to see doctors and other health care providers. Mark Holmes, a health policy professor with the Gillings School of Global Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill, says it is generally believed that many of those currently eligible but not enrolled are healthier and as a result less costly to the state. And Adam Linker, a health policy analyst with the North Carolina Justice Center, adds that it is likely that not all 250,000 would enroll immediately and that it could take 2 to 3 years or longer for that to happen. The state has to plan for the upper end of costs, but it really could be less if people are not consuming at the rates predicted, says Linker. And now we turn to the Biz column in the Triangle Business Journal. The headline that starts it off, Downtown's the bomb for law firm that re-ups lease. Downtown Raleigh boosters raise the champagne. A staple of downtown is staying put. After several months of negotiations, the Smith Anderson law firm has signed a contract worth an estimated $30 million plus to stay in the Wachovia Capital Center Tower in downtown Raleigh, where the firm plans to expand. Smith Anderson, the largest law firm in the Triangle, with 122 lawyers and 90 staff members, was one of the building's first tenants when it opened in 1991. The new commitment is for at least another 16 years. The lease, which includes the option of 2 5-year extensions, was signed with the building's landlord, Spectrum Properties, on October 26. Smith Anderson is adding an additional floor to the deal, bringing its total space occupied to 92,000 square feet on floors 23 through 27. That George Holding is a brave man, and his wife is a very understanding woman. In early October, Holding, the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of North Carolina, headed out for a week-long visit to Kosovo, the world's youngest country, as part of an ongoing training program designed to help the tiny Eastern European nation develop the rule of law. They recognize that's the key ingredient to get their country off to the right start, says Holding, who calls it a humbling experience to be part of the birth of a nation. But that's not the birth that Biz is worried about. Turns out that Holding's wife, Lucy, gave birth to a baby boy. William Royal Holding, just 4 days before Pops left the country. That meant Lucy had to look after 4 kids, including the newborn, while George was off polishing his statesmanship credentials on a European jaunt. So how exactly did that work out for him? She's fully supportive of the mission, says Holding. I'm not much use around the house anyway. Durham's Only Burger hasn't parked its truck, but the storefront version is now open in the Hope Valley Square Center in Durham. Biz checked it out and can attest that the burgers are just as good as they are at the mobile operation. Finding a seat took a little work, as there aren't many of them, and there were lots of people trying to get them. The United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County is about to kick off its annual fundraiser, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner? The nonprofit organization will offer dinners on November 4 through November 6 at different homes in Wake County, with each event featuring a guest artist with ties to North Carolina. The guest artist remains a secret until diners arrive. Among those opening their homes for the evening are Nancy and Doyle Parrish, Libby and Jeff Barber, Peggy and Jim Fain, Julia and Frank Daniels, Carrie and Jerry Stoltz, and Brenda and Ron Gibson. All proceeds from the event go to support the council, which works to promote a vibrant arts community in Wake County. While the events are nearly sold out, seats are still available. To find out more, go online to guesswho.unitedarts.org. When Biz headed over to the legendary confines of Dorton Arena on October 23 to enjoy the Darius Rucker concert at the North Carolina State Fair, it was with the knowledge that there would be some pop mixed in with the former Hootie and the Blowfish frontman's more recent country offerings. What Biz didn't expect was to hear so many covers from other great artists. In addition to his country and Hootie hits, Rucker and his band played homage to Hank Williams Jr. with a rendition of Family Tradition, and to David Allan Coe with a version of You Never Even Called Me By My Name. But Rucker saved the most unexpected number for the final encore when he provided his take on Prince's Purple Rain. Now that's a set list. Bet this won't help when it comes time to bury the hatchet. As most people hereabouts know, Raleigh-Durham International Airport has been feuding with several newspapers, including the News and Observer, about RDU's ban on newspaper racks in its terminals. The newspapers prevailed in court earlier this year, and a contingent from the NNO took a trip over to speak to the airport authority about the issue at RDU's monthly meeting in October. Publisher Orange Quarles was late arriving and revealed some bad news during his opening remarks. He had blown a tire on the way over while traveling through some road construction near the airport. "I'll be talking to you afterwards, John," Quarles said in a mock accusation, implying that the airport was at fault for his misfortune. John, of course, would be Airport Director John Brantley. For the record, the construction was the work of the North Carolina Department of Transportation. "Watch out, Gene Conti." North Carolina IT officials are asking for your input for a planned update of the state's website at www.nc.gov. Sought are ideas about what residents want and need from the new site. Those interested can go online and answer a 9-question survey through November 5. A release from the state IT official stated, "The goal is to build a site that makes it easier for everyone to obtain information about and perform transactions with NC State Government. The survey is at www.surveymonkey.com/s/ncgovwebdesign. Start singing the news, da-da, da-da-da. Most folks from the Triangle know that WRAL's Pam Salisbury can deliver the news, but most don't know that she has a passion for singing. So here's the news. Salisbury will launch her debut CD titled The Full Measure of a Woman on November 1. On the CD, the Emmy-winning anchorwoman sings standards and jazz songs that she finds especially sassy, strong, and sultry. The CD sells for about $10. Check it out at www.pamsalisbury.com. UNC Chapel Hill's Law School is bringing some big names in civil rights to town for a civil rights conference next month. Guests at the event will include Lynn Huntley, the president of the Southern Education Foundation, Brian Stevenson, executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, and Elaine Jones, former director counsel and president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. The conference will be held on November 1 and 2 at the Friday Center. UNC Law School says that topics will include education, housing, and career opportunities. Winter is coming. Believe us, it'll be here sometime. And Piedmont Natural Gas is taking a step to help those least able to cover their heating bills. The natural gas utility has donated $100,000 to the Share the Warmth Fund, which helps residential customers with their utility bills. Piedmont also allows its customers to contribute to the effort with its Share the Warmth Roundup program. Customers can round up their bill to the nearest dollar, and the difference goes to the program. Those contributions are projected to raise another $90,000. All Share the Warmth Roundup contributions stay in the communities in which they were received. Utility customers who receive help from the fund can use the assistance to pay for energy bills throughout the year, regardless of the energy source. Southeast BIO has announced the lineup of life sciences companies that will participate in its annual investor forum. And the nonprofit organization's guest list features several Triangle firms. They include Research Triangle Park-based BioShape Solutions Incorporated, Durham-based Physient Incorporated, Chapel Hill-based SkyTel Research, and Cary-based Vascular Pharmaceuticals Incorporated. The conference will be November 3 and 4 at the Ritz-Carlton Buckhead in Atlanta. Party with the animals this Halloween at the SPCA of Wake County's 5th annual Halloween celebration, and that's Howl Oween, H-O-W-L. On Saturday, October 30, from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., the SPCA's Curtis Dale Pet Adoption Center will be the site of Halloween crafts, sweets, games, and a fashion show featuring dogs awaiting new homes. A small donation or animal-related item is requested as admission, and partiers are asked to leave their own pets at home so those in the shelter can take center stage. A $15,000 diamond ring could be yours for free. All you have to do is find it. Bailey's Fine Jewelry will kick off its ultimate Finders Keepers jewelry hunt on November 6th with a high-tech scavenger hunt across downtown Raleigh. Bailey's owners, who occasionally leave a piece of jewelry and a note randomly around town for anyone to find and keep, will hide the $15,000 ring somewhere in downtown Raleigh. But only qualified couples participating in the hunt will have the tools to find it. Any couple or team of two must register to participate at www.baileysultimatefinderskeepers.com by filling out a registration form. Bailey's will choose the winners to participate in the treasure hunt. The hunt will use text messages or an iPhone Android application to deliver clues to participants who can travel on foot or by bike. Cars are not allowed. The team that solves the most clues will find and keep the diamond ring. The event, which is Bailey's second such hunt in Raleigh, will kick off at 11 a.m. at Licton Plaza in front of the Progress Energy Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Raleigh. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance has won an award from the International Downtown Association for its You Are Here branding campaign, which was launched in conjunction with the rollout of the downtown R-Line bus circulator and the implementation of Wi-Fi access. The campaign was selected from 73 submissions. Kit Kramer, president and CEO of IDA, says, DRA's branding campaign set a new bar for downtown organizations. The award committee was very impressed by their comprehensive execution of the brand. Very impressive. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Chris Basden, Cameron Snipes, James Gallagher, and Frank Van Leeuwen. And now we're going to turn to the executive profile in the Triangle Business Journal. And this one is of Deborah Townsley, president of Peace College. And along with the article, there's a large picture of her sitting outside of one of the buildings on campus next to a statue. The caption reads, Peace President Deborah Townsley took over the reins from Laura Bingham. And the headline on the profile, From a Corporate Marketer to Head of Venerable College. And this is written by James Gallagher with a Dateline of Raleigh. When Deborah Townsley bought a condo in Wilmington 6 years ago, it was because she thought the coastal city would be a great place to retire once she concluded her career in Massachusetts. Little did she know then that she would end up living just a couple of hours' drive up the road. Townsley started in August as Peace College's 10th president, succeeding Laura Bingham, who retired earlier this year. The move south is giving the 55-year-old Townsley the opportunity to continue the efforts Bingham accelerated in growing Peace. The school is positioned with such a strong foundation, that foundation allows me to take it and bring it to the next level and up into the future, Townsley says. Among the first actions Townsley took after assuming the helm at Peace was to ask the school's faculty and staff to examine themselves and to offer them buyouts and early retirements to give the college flexibility as it moves forward. Joe Wolf, a professor of biology and the head of the faculty senate, says he thinks she's doing a good job so far. She's asking us to examine ourselves top to bottom and asking us how we can be better. Anyone who does that is doing us a service, he says. Townsley says she is looking to offer graduate programs at the Raleigh Institution, though she hasn't decided in what fields. She says Peace needs to find a niche in graduate education. We can't be all things to all people, she says. Townsley brings to Peace a career that spans both industry and academia. She started her professional career in marketing with IBM and then worked as an IT consultant for Booz Allen and Hamilton in Maryland. After earning an MBA, she started teaching business courses and eventually ended up at the University of Vermont, where she earned a master's degree and PhD in organizational psychology. In the preceding years, she had worked as both an administrator and professor, and she decided to pursue a career in higher education administration. She took a job as Dean of Academic Affairs at Nichols College, a small institution in Dudley, Massachusetts. After less than a year there, the college's president left, and the board asked Townsley to step in. She accepted. Though the job took a great deal of time, she says it was not uncommon for her young children to sleep in her office when they were sick and couldn't go to school. It's a position she relishes. I love graduation because that is the result of what you do, she says. Townsley spent 13 years at the helm of Nichols before moving to Raleigh. She says she was drawn to Peace because of its mission, its past success, and its location, and because she saw a challenge in continuing to grow Peace. Her husband, Mark Townsley, is convinced she is the right person for the job. She understands higher education, and I write about higher education as well as anyone I know, says Mark Townsley, who has written a book on the financial management of small colleges. She is versed in what you need to make an institution successful. The two met about 7 years ago when they were asked to give a joint presentation on college finances at a conference in Tennessee. About a year later, they were again paired for a similar presentation at a conference in Massachusetts and started dating soon after. So far, Townsley says they have taken some day trips around the area, visiting Chapel Hill, Durham, and Hillsboro, where they stumbled upon an auction. I love auctions, she says, adding that it is fun to look at strange things and wonder, what are people going to do with that? And the couple has recently rescued 3 dogs, one for her husband, and one for her son, Jerron. As for the condo in Wilmington, Townsley says she visited it more frequently when she lived in Massachusetts than since moving to Raleigh. But it is getting used. Her younger daughter, Johanna, who is a 5th grade teacher in Wilmington, has been living there for the past year and a half. And there's a gray block with some information concerning Deborah Townsley. Age, 55. Family, husband Mark Townsley and 3 children, Jenna, 28, Johanna, 25, and Jerron, 21. Education, PhD in Industrial Organizational Psychology from the University of Vermont, MA in Psychology from the University of Vermont, MBA from George Washington University, Bachelor of Science in Business Administration from American University, and Associate Degree from Northern Virginia Community College. And now we return to our full-length standard articles in the Triangle Business Journal. And the first one we'll read has the headline, Serial Entrepreneur Starts Firm That Assists Senior Living. And this article is written by Frank Van Leeuwen with the Dateline of Durham. And within the article, there's a picture of a man sitting at a desk showing some technology that he has with him. The caption reads, Ajit Penzi was a founder of Trinity Convergence in Durham. It's a cliche of television infomercials. An elderly woman falls in her home and can't get up. The suggested solution is a panic alert button. Serial entrepreneur Ajit Penzi is betting his latest venture can bring a new twist to the old cliche. Durham-based Palm Devices has developed a new monitoring and communication system that will keep tabs on seniors and maintain contact with family. It's a different tack for the Intel veteran who went on to lead telecommunications startups eFusion in Oregon and Trinity Convergence of Durham, 2 venture capital-backed businesses that were both eventually acquired by larger companies. Palm Devices has been backed by angel investors. Penzi says he's open to partnering with a larger company but has enough money to support Palm Devices for now. Penzi, whose inspiration for Palm Devices came from a conversation with his mother-in-law, says seniors represent an untapped market for technology companies. The U.S. market for technology products targeting the elderly is currently about $2 billion and is forecast to grow to $20 billion by 2020, according to Florida-based consulting firm Aging in Place Technology Watch. Lori Orloff, founder of the firm, says despite the market potential, these technologies are not widely deployed because of lack of awareness of the products. She adds that tech companies cling to a mistaken belief that seniors aren't interested in new technology. Although remote monitoring technologies have been around for about 5 years, Orloff estimates less than 10,000 units are in use today. But she says Palm Devices product called Sonamba enters the market at a time when the number of available assisted living beds is declining and seniors increasingly want to continue living at home. Sensor systems that monitor seniors' movement are available from companies such as HealthSense and Living Independently Group, but outfitting a house with sensors runs close to $8,000. Sonamba sells for $459, not including a $39 monthly fee for wireless capabilities. If a senior falls, alerts can be sent to a caregiver or loved one via text message or email carried on a wireless network. The system also reminds seniors when to take their medications. Pensy initially tried developing a system for smartphones, which have GPS location capabilities, but Pensy says he found that seniors don't like the smaller screens of smartphones. His 10-employee company, along with contract workers, developed new hardware and software. Mitch Stromben of Chapel Hill consultancy Metamorphos says the market has a number of vendors that focus on specific objectives. Some make systems whose sensors monitor a senior's movements, detecting falls. Others focus on medicine reminders, even dispensing pills at designated times. Sonamba looks to have some interesting capabilities, but I do wonder how many people want an all-in-one product that may be good in many areas, but potentially not the best in class in any one area, he says. Although seniors are the intended users, they are not Pensy's target customer. He's seeking the attention of people in their 40s and 50s who are comfortable with technology and want to use it as a caregiving tool for their parents. While the market for these technologies is still developing, the products are getting attention from healthcare companies. Living Independently Group, maker of the Quiet Care Monitoring System, was acquired by GE Healthcare last December after GE had previously taken a minority stake in the New York-based company. Financial terms were not disclosed. Our next article is written by Chris Basden with a Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, Southwest Wake Roads, Part of Overall Transportation Plan. And then there's also within the article a picture of a road with some buildings on the side and quite a few cars on the road. The caption reads, NC-55 is among roads being studied for improvements. Transportation planners at the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization are aiming their crosshairs on the southwestern part of Wake County and the northwestern section of Harnett County with a new study that will determine what road improvements need to be made in the area in the decades to come. CAMPO, C-A-M-P-O, recently received proposals from six engineering firms interested in conducting what's being called the Southwest Area Study, and the organization plans to select the winner over the next several weeks. The firms are Raleigh-based Martin Alexiou Bryson PC, San Francisco-based URS Corporation, Cary-based Kimley Horn & Associates Incorporated, New York City-based PP Americas, Columbia, South Carolina-based BP Barber, and Edmonton, Canada-based Stantec. The complete report should be finished by mid-year 2012 and also will include information on future transit service. The study will cost between $600,000 and $800,000, according to CAMPO transportation planner Gerald Daniel. The report will examine potential road improvements and land use possibilities for an area north of the Cape Fear River in Lillington, up to US 164 in Apex. Roads examined in the study will include NC-210, NC-55, US 1, and US 401. Like the rest of the triangle, that area has experienced a great deal of growth over the past decade, growth that's leading to congestion. We need better connections around the east side of Fuquay and the west side of Fuquay, says Dan Andrews, a Harnett County commissioner who also serves on CAMPO's Transportation Advisory Committee. The population is expected to continue to rise in the years to come, in part because Fort Bragg and Fayetteville did so well in the base realignment and closure plan. BRAC, as it's known, is the impetus behind the relocation of the U.S. Forces Command and the U.S. Army Reserve Command from Fort McPherson in Georgia up to Fort Bragg, a process that will result in 2,800 new military and civilian jobs in the area. CAMPO does a lot of general transportation studies, but Director Ed Johnson says This one, we're really trying to put the high beams on it and get pretty specific. While studies like this don't always sound terribly sexy, they are the first step in a long process that leads to road projects that eventually encourage development and jobs. We have to have good planning, says Wake County Commissioner Joe Bryan, who heads up the Transportation Advisory Committee. Transportation links so much to land use. Bryan says that in addition to identifying road improvements, the study also will prioritize them so that the region can get more bang for its transportation buck. Durham lures digital smiths. This article is written by Frank Van Leeuwen with the Dateline of Durham. And off to the right side of the article, there's a picture of a young man wearing glasses, a button-up shirt. The caption reads, "Digital Smith's Ben Weinberger says the American Tobacco Campus is a good fit." Internet video technology company Digital Smith, which has grown its headcount by a third over the past year, is joining other hip companies looking for appropriate space, the American Tobacco Campus in Digital Smith's case. CEO Ben Weinberger says the decision to relocate from Morrisville to Durham was prompted by the expiration of the company's lease. He adds that he and Digital Smith's co-founder, Matt Berry, were looking for a creative environment that fits young, early-stage technology companies. At American Tobacco, the company will join technology tenants such as Bronto Software and Pocket Gear. "We wanted the business and environment we work in to reflect the culture we have. American Tobacco was a great fit," Weinberger says. At 6,584 square feet, Digital Smith's new offices won't be much bigger than the company's current space just off Airport Boulevard. But Weinberger says the layout is better, and it will allow the company to add more people. With the move, the company will be trading traditional drywall for exposed brick and beams. Digital Smith's current headcount is 36. New employees added over the past year include COO Gregory Hodges, former president of Salt Lake City company Ibon, who joined Digital Smiths in July. Ibon provides digital information and entertainment for the hospitality industry. Weinberger says the company is always looking for software engineers and is also hiring sales staff. The company last year opened a business development office in Los Angeles, its only satellite location. Digital Smith's technology allows for searching and indexing of online video. The company sells to businesses primarily in media and entertainment that have large collections of video. Customers include TMZ, Paramount Pictures, and The Tyra Banks Show. Consumers are demonstrating a growing appetite for online videos. ComScore estimates that 175 million U.S. Internet users watched online videos in September, averaging 14.4 hours of viewing for the month. A year ago, 168 million viewers watched online videos, averaging 9.8 hours for the month. Weinberger declined to disclose revenue for privately held Digital Smiths. He says revenue has been growing and the company is on its way to profitability. Digital Smiths is backed by about $18 million in venture capital investment from the Aurora Funds, Chrysalis Ventures, 406 Ventures, and Cisco Systems. Wright Steenrod, principal at Chrysalis, referred questions about the company to Weinberger, but he says Chrysalis is pleased with its investment. Jerry Caffold, an analyst at research firm Instat, says there is no clear leader in the digital video space, which is served by many small, privately held firms. Other vendors include United Kingdom-based Blinx, VideoSurf, based in California, and Arizona company PixLogic. Caffold says some companies specialize in a particular kind of video search. PixLogic's technology, for example, can read license plates from a video, a feature that has a law enforcement application. While entertainment is a growing area for online video companies, Caffold says the next big step is bringing video search and indexing capabilities to the enterprise. Businesses are finding that they have a lot of video in storage, and with the right tools, they can monetize it. Insurance companies, for example, can catalog videos of car wrecks to get better information about automobile accidents. Business applications of the technology started taking off this year, Caffold says. Weinberger says that although Digital Smiths has customers using its video capabilities in a corporate setting, the company's technology is primarily used by entertainment companies. Judging the judges. That's the headline on our next article. This one written by Chris Basden with a dateline of Charlotte. Representatives of the North Carolina Bar Association are developing a proposal to overhaul the selection process for the state superior court and appellate judges in an effort to improve the candidate pool and mitigate problems caused by lack of voter knowledge about those running. Changing the current system in which judges are chosen by popular vote of the electorate faces a high hurdle. A constitutional amendment would have to be approved by 3/5 of the members of each chamber of the state legislature, and then voters would have to approve the amendment. Heading up the effort for change for the Bar Association are Charlotte lawyer John Wester, an attorney with Robinson Bradshaw, and former state Supreme Court Chief Justice Jim Exum, who now works for Smithmore Leatherwood in Greensboro. While details on the bar's proposed plan are still being worked out, it would call for two major changes: the creation of a bipartisan nominating committee to vet candidates for open positions, and the use of retention elections to decide whether sitting judges get to serve another term. The basic proposal calls for interested candidates to send in applications to the vetting committee, which would select two candidates to face each other in the general election. The nominating committee would take the place of a primary election, explains Wester, who thinks the change would ensure that whoever won the election would be qualified for the job. The nominating committee would have a dozen members, including people appointed by the governor and the majority and minority leaders of both houses of the General Assembly. That's an idea that is certain to create controversy due to the potential politics that could be involved. Are we adding another layer of possible influence with the committee? Asked Scott Gaylord, a professor at Elon University's law school. Keeping the job after a judge won the general election would be easier under the bar's plan. Judges who wanted to run again after their terms ended would simply face a retention election, a yes or no vote on whether they keep the job, not an election against another opponent. Exum says the idea is to help keep good judges in place instead of having them ousted for no good reason. Supporters of change worry that voters don't have or decline to gain enough knowledge about judicial candidates to make an informed decision at the polls. As evidence, Wester points out that North Carolina voters in the 2008 general election cast 1.2 million fewer votes, or about 30% fewer, for North Carolina Supreme Court candidates than they did for the presidential candidates. And he asserts that many voters who did vote for Supreme Court candidates did so based on factors unrelated to the merit of the candidates, such as name recognition or ballot position. Other concerns about judicial elections include the rising influence of money on campaigns and the fear that a grinding campaign process can dissuade the best judicial candidates from running. We're playing with fire here, says Wester. There's a good way to deal with this, and we're past due to do it. The bar, which is a trade group representing lawyers, hopes to have legislators introduce some version of its plan at the General Assembly in the upcoming session. Whatever might emerge will face an uphill battle, say state legal insiders. We've never gotten the legislature to come close to something like that, says former North Carolina Supreme Court Chief Justice Burley Mitchell, who is not involved in the formation of the bar's plan. Mitchell says he understands the motivations behind the bar's proposed plan. He says it would require a great deal of research for the public to be well-versed on the merits of judicial candidates. And while he enjoyed campaigning, Mitchell says it was difficult to do that and handle his judicial workload. Instead of establishing a vetting committee, Mitchell simply favors having the governor appoint judges. Former North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr also thinks that having the governor appoint judges is a better way to do it than the bar's proposal. The system needs to be changed, says Orr. There are far more simple ways to do it than the bar's idea. And with our remaining minutes, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Triangle falls to fourth smartest city. The Triangle has fallen from its perch as the brainiest city in the United States. That's according to the Daily Beast's second annual Smartest City report, which ranks the nation's 55 largest cities on factors such as educational attainment and intellectual environment. Think book sales and educational institutions per capita. Boston claimed the top spot on the list, dethroning Raleigh-Durham, which fell to fourth. Las Vegas came in last. Nearly 60 homes sold in auction. The auctioneers of Auction.com made a quick stop in the Triangle as part of an 8-city campaign through the Southeast. The event helped facilitate the sale of 58 homes for $2.6 million. All of the homes included in the auction event were in foreclosure and bank-owned. Among its deals of the day was a bid for a home at 5224 Passenger Place in Raleigh for $73,500, which was 50% less than its previous high value of $144,614, according to officials with Auction.com. A home at 6017 Hope Farm Lane in Wake Forest had a high bid of $283,500, which was 40% less than its previous high value of $472,910. Landlord mulls RBC Center upgrades. Centennial Authority board members are considering updating a plan that outlines future capital improvement projects at the RBC Center. The original study was put together by HOK Sport about 5 years ago at a cost of $75,000. But Authority board member Michael Weeks says that a lot of the items in that document, including installing a new sound system and scoreboard and renovating suites, have been completed. One thing that wasn't mentioned in the old plan, but which will be needed soon, is a new basketball court, says Arena General Manager Dave Olson. The RBC Center is home to the NHL's Carolina Hurricanes and NC State's men's basketball team. NC State Fair nets $4.1 million from rides. The North Carolina State Fair's take from Powers Great American Midways, the carnival operator at this year's event, is nearly $4.1 million, according to spokesman Brian Long. The fair already had announced that its attendance at the event topped the $1 million mark, but the carnival operator's tab is based on the number of paid attendees, which clocked in at 788,318. The payment is based on a rate of $5.20 per person who buys a ticket to the fair or exchanges 4 cans of food for admission on Food Lion Hunger Relief Day, according to information provided by Long in an email. Admission revenue has yet to be counted. North Hills unveils slew of new shops. Several new merchants will be opening at the North Hills mixed-use development over the next several weeks. Among the retailers that will be opening next month are the Triangle's 9th Massage Envy Spa, the first inland location of the iconic Outer Banks Whalebone Urban Surf Shop, a locally owned seller of olive oils and vinegars called Midtown Olive Press, and Haley's Boutique, which is moving from its Five Points location. Barbecue brawl. Dickies faces off with Cooper's. Let the barbecue battles begin. The Texas-based Dickies Barbecue Pit restaurant chain has opened its doors to its first customers in downtown Raleigh, and it has done so across the street from the well-established Clyde Cooper's Barbecue. Dickies will be open daily from 11 a.m. until 9 p.m. at 170 East Davie Street. Clyde Cooper's, known for its Eastern North Carolina-style pulled pork dishes, is located at 109 East Davie Street. The restaurant has been in operation in Raleigh since 1938. And we'll stop there with our reading of the Triangle Business Journal as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Well, be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.